The Fart Zone would have been a better name than the write-up in some ways.
The Fart Zone.
Where creatives share what's inside of them. KUT's The Flatulence Zone. Hello, and welcome to The Write-Up, a KUT-produced program that centers on conversations with creatives. I'm Owen Edgerton, your host, and today we have writer Amelia Gray. Amelia Gray writes nightmares and fables, uncanny truths weaved into startling images. Her story collection, AMPM, Museum of the Weird, and her novel, Threats, are quickly winning her a reputation as one of the most exhilarating writers writing today. Her most recent collection, Gutshot, is a fascinating, terrifying, hilarious, and heartbreaking, often all at the very same moment. It's a pleasure to have Amelia Gray back in Austin and a guest on The Write-Up.
Thank you.
Hi, Amelia.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to see you, too.
Yeah. Would you, to get started, would you be up for reading to us from Gutshot?
Yes, I would love to. I will read Gutshot from the collection Gutshot.
Brilliant. A brilliant choice.
A natural choice.
Yes. It seems inevitable.
The man was Gutshot. His blood welled around his hands and soaked his shirt. "I'm Gutshot," he said. The man who had shot him lowered his weapon. "That is definitely what I intended to happen," he said. "But now that it's happened, I feel things have gone too far." The Gutshot man drove to a hospital. "Doctor, I'm Gutshot," the man said. "This is terrible," the doctor said. "Wow, what are you going to do?" "I hoped you would know," said the man. "It has been many years since I practiced medicine. They let me stay here. Soon they will name a surgical ward after me, where men who are Gutshot can be cared for." The doctor drove them to the home where the Gutshot man's mother lived. "Mother, I'm Gutshot," he cried. "My sweetheart," his mother said, "woe descends upon us all." "I'm not sure it's as bad as all that," the man said. "Upon the beginning and the last end, view only the comfort of darkness." "He seems to be pulling together," said the doctor, who had returned with a set of towels to staunch the blood. "All ye who pass through these walls and halls will know only pain through the end of days. Please don't use the guest towels." "We're going to go sit outside," the man said. The doctor helped the man to a place behind the house, where an elm tree made a bed of fallen leaves. "Good luck," the doctor said, climbing over a fence and running for the road. "Jesus Christ, I'm Gutshot," the man said. "Well, now I won't help you," Jesus Christ said. He was seated on a low branch. The bottoms of his sandals gently brushed the man's forehead. "It speaks to a lack of respect, you know." "Truly?" the man asked. "Just kidding," said Jesus Christ. "I love you. I also love the man who gutshot you, and I love what you're doing to those guest towels." "Will you help me, though?" "Oh, sure. Do you see that airplane up there?" Jesus Christ pointed until the man saw a silver glint in the sky. "The people in that plane are flying to Dallas," Jesus Christ said. "There is an old woman who feeds the stray cats in her neighborhood, and a dentist, and a little baby who will grow up to be in asset management. There is a pilot who loves the smell of masking tape, and a woman who doesn't know what she wants to do with her life and will eventually stop wondering." "And they're all going to Dallas," the man said. "Does that help?" Jesus Christ asked. The man leaned against the tree trunk. His vision flared and blurred. "I think so," he said.
That's Amelia Gray reading the story Gutshot from the collection Gutshot. I love that you chose that story. I'm in love with that story. The collection is fantastic. It's beautiful. I've always loved your writing, and this book just wowed me in all kinds of ways. And frightened me. It's funny. I was reading it the other morning, and I was my family was all gone, but we had cleared off the sheets off the bed, and my couch was covered with some books and papers from projects. And I was like, where am I gonna sit? Where am I gonna read? And, my daughter's bed is open. And my daughter's bed was the one place. So I went into my 10-year-old daughter's bedroom and kind of cuddled up next to her big teddy bear, and I started reading these stories. I'm like, I feel like I'm in a scene from an Amelia Gray short story. Like the wallpaper is going to start sucking on my face or something.
But that does set the scene pretty nicely. I like that.
Let's start with actually the story Gutshot, because that was one of the ones. There was a couple of quotes in there that struck me as really interesting insights into your writing. One thing I wanted to ask you about the comedy. Because you do such the book is, as people and critics have been pointing out, at times terrifying and surreal, but also hilarious. And you do this wonderful job of balancing is the wrong word, marrying humor and horror. Mm. So I wanted to ask you about that. What do you feel that relationship is between what's horrific and what's hilarious and where the two meet?
Yeah. I mean, it's a hard one, as you know, as also a funny human in this world. Yeah. that humor is very bodily, you know, and being alive is very bodily, and being alive is very funny, and it's very terrible.
Yeah.
And this march towards death and the very kind of real, like, physical sense of your own decay.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
At some point we stop growing and start shrinking, you know,
right,
physically. And that's so strange and funny to me. Or maybe it's so awful that you have to laugh at it. It's a kind of the darkness or the humor coming from pain. There's got to be a word for that, I
right
think.
Yeah. I'm sure people have written about it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Once or twice.
Once or twice.
There might be a book out there. But
yeah, there is. But there's also something, I mean, that's so true that it's, you know, you have to laugh or you'd cry.
Right.
But also there is something innately funny, even about our own decay.
Yeah,
which,
yeah,
is strange and wonderful. I mean, you know, Gutshot is as a short story itself, it's concentrating on a guy who from the very beginning is dying. I mean, that's all we know about a Gutshot is, that's people die in Gutshot. And I've read enough Westerns that I know that about the word. It might be all I know.
Yeah.
Someone's been shot in the gut and they're going to die.
Yeah.
And then the word itself, you make the word, which means death, which means a death sentence. It becomes this funny reoccurring beat, and the word takes on its own humor.
Yeah, that's cool. I never thought of this exactly, but it's a death sentence. Yeah,
yeah,
it's bad. It's like you put a, what was it? I feel like there's some Western. I mean, this is all we're all drawing this from things we have read.
Yes,
to two nerds in a room.
Right. It's Larry McMurtry, right? It's
like right. Yeah. You like press a piece of bread onto somebody's like ear, and if there's blood in it, you're like, well, he's dead. That's it.
That's right.
Forget about it. And then you have to eat the bread because you're so hungry. It's impossible to get away from.
And that's where blood bread was invented.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the tradition of blood bread.
Right, yeah.
Well, let me ask you, you get compared a lot to Kelly Link, Amy Bender, other writers like Kafka too, who write in fables.
Yeah.
I was wondering what draws you to that. What draws you to the world of fables, a world in your stories which is kind of just left of reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started writing in a philosophy class, and the teacher was really kind, and she allowed us to either write essays that talked about the ideas that we were studying, or like write stories that demonstrated them in fiction. And I was immediately drawn to that. And I don't know if it was maybe growing up religious, like in the Presbyterian church every Sunday for 18 years, or if it was some element of reading and loving a lot of fables, and somehow being, I guess thanks to my parents, like given and exposed to the Grimm brothers and Japanese fables and Aesop and like a whole like broad spectrum of that of fables and Greek kind of myths and Just it felt like the closest point from the fastest way to go from point A to point B in terms of understanding an idea was to write a story about it. So, like, yeah. I would, you know, if I felt heartbroken and I didn't understand the feeling of it, but I thought about a man climbing up onto a billboard and thinking about his love on a billboard and being a complete idiot about it or something, and that was my way to kind of explain it to myself.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that the image or the fable logic mm-hmm. I suppose says more than a dictionary definition might.
Yeah, yeah. And I love Amy and Kelly's work both. It does that stuff so well. And Amy's story about there's like a mother who she eats her mother or something, yeah. And disgorges her mother.
Right,
and
yeah.
Lots of that stuff.
You like that?
I like that. It makes sense to me. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Feels good.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Amy Bender and Kelly Link, and you are some of my favorite writers writing today.
Oh, man, thanks.
Within that, you were talking about growing up religious. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that and how that influences your writing.
Well, I know for sure that it gave me a sense of cadence,
yeah,
to my writing. And I think you have that kind of upbringing also.
I've got a bit of that in my,
yeah,
background.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're like, uh-huh, yeah, yeah. And just the like, when you sit in a room with people and you're saying, like, incanting the same thing over and over again, and then you read this book that is this kind of got this real poetic sense, like just the things, I think sometimes in iambs, and it's not out of any kind of brilliance of my own, although I'll take easy credit for it. It's just kind of this study and practice and doing like the short catechism,
yeah,
like, and memorizing that stuff. And I don't know. I owe a big debt to that feeling. And then of course all the fables and all the things that fell out of that are,
yeah,
similar. And then also like the strangeness of it. You know, I mean, and I was Presbyterian, not we didn't do any kind of transubstantiation, we didn't claim those right. abilities, but I mean, it's powerful stuff that,
yeah,
people are claiming in,
gosh,
those rooms.
Yeah. You're talking about Amy Bender, mm-hmm, the story about eating your mother,
right?
There we are, eating God,
right?
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
well, within that too, and this just occurred to me as you were talking just then, I was like, there's also in organized religion, of course, the aspect of ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of your stories seem to fall into ritual, in that something bizarre happens and then it happens again and then it happens again. A girl wakes up and she's had a baby in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next night she has another baby, and then a third night and she wakes up and another baby. And, mm-hmm, there's like a ritual where the unusual, the glimpse into the bizarre is reenacted and reenacted and reenacted.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we need rituals to live. We crave rituals. And even when we don't want to do the rituals, it's essential to perform these rituals. I mean, I've, you know, witnessed friends, you know, burying their parents, and it's such an awful one to have to do, but necessary, like so necessary. And,
yeah,
and I think about burial rites and rituals. I was just in this, one of those mineral springs in Albuquerque, and the woman covered me in mud, and,
yeah,
then she wrapped me in like a shawl, and then she did like a scrub thing and then a mud thing and then a wrap thing, and then I was kind of wrapped up like the Virgin Mary a little bit,
yeah,
and then she was like, all right, now we'll walk you to like the tub area. But I had to walk through the whole place where everyone is like in bathing suits and just like talking and reading their books, and I'm like a kind of saint,
yeah,
in my own mind, barefoot and kind of lionized and wrapped in robes. And I got to the tub on the other side, and she put me in the water and she left, and I just started crying and crying. It was so like, there's something there. I don't know.
Well, it's like you walked, I mean, like a saint, but also like a corpse.
Like a corpse,
prepared,
yeah,
for
burial.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's exactly how that felt. And once I got out of there, I went and told Lee, my boyfriend. I was like, you have to try that. It's just like you're getting prepared for burial. And he's like, cool, I think I'll skip that. We're just going to get a glass of wine, actually, and sit in the hot tub.
That's good, too. That's a ritual, too.
A different kind, yeah.
You've written a lot about grief, too. I mean, Threats was a grief-soaked book.
Yeah.
And maybe a discovery of rituals there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Threats was all about me as a person in her late 20s at the time, figuring out, like, what is it like to love somebody until they die?
Yeah.
Until you die, you know, what is the feeling of that, and how, like, what's the reality of that? Because I think I wasn't in a relationship at the time, and it was a curiosity, a strangeness to me. I imagine it still is, now that I am in a serious thing, it's like, God, what is that going to be like?
Right.
And it's more like, what is it like now? Because you're moving through life as you're considering the future of it. And,
yeah.
That's just, it's wild to me. So Threats was about, I don't know, maybe preparing myself for that idea or working through it in some way. And also writing a weird, cool mystery.
Yeah. I mean, with those kind of questions, I mean, do you even come to answers? Or do you just come to that fable image that you were talking about earlier, where you're describing to yourself as a kid, like, oh, this is how I feel?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I think the answer I came to was so simple as to be obvious, which is maybe how novels are sometimes, of just like, the answer is like, love is real.
Yeah.
And like, okay, great. But I really did have to think about it and work on it for a couple years to be like, yeah, love's real.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think you're so right that sometimes the simple conclusion, the real truths, but it takes hundreds of pages to bring us there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially if we're a little slow.
I'm particularly slow.
Same. Yeah. It takes years.
Yeah. So we're talking about ritual, going from there. I'm curious as to your writing process and the rituals that are involved there. What is that like? You okay with sharing some of how the sausage is made?
As it were. It's changed a little bit because I used to actually ascribe to Amy Bender's theory of you write the moment you wake up before your dreams burn off, which is such a beautiful image. And I took it on when I was in school, and I had my laptop by my bed, and I was just writing with my eyes half open, just kind of churning it out, have little bits of dreams in there, and like a more maybe easy willingness to experiment or whatever. And then
and that was when you were writing AMPM?
Yeah, AMPM, and then a little bit of Museum of the Weird, for sure.
Yeah.
And then with Threats, I had more kind of a workman attitude. I would get up, I would drink a glass of milk, and then I would write a little, and then I would get my coffee as like a reward for having written a little.
Yeah.
So that was a different kind of feeling. And then I would edit and do other, that was when I was marketing writing, which was a lot of work.
That was your day job,
my day
so
job,
to speak. Yeah.
Right. And then writing part of Gutshot, and then the novel I'm working on now, I had a serious day job, 50 hours a week in advertising and 2-hour a day commute. So I would get up, drive to work, sit down, try to get there before the other creatives got in.
Yeah.
Right. And then when requests started coming in, then I would finally, you know, go back to those. So then I don't know what that means. Well, in editing, I will tell you, it means that I find that I stopped in the middle of paragraphs or sentences. And so I wrote TK and then left and just like, okay, what was coming?
Wow.
We'll find out.
2-hour commute. And that's in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So it was like a mile from your house.
Right. I could have rolled downhill. I had to take the 101 to the 110, to MLK to the 90, who knows what that even is.
Should write while driving.
Oh God. I tried. There's one voice memo of me describing what would become the story of the man ahead. And cause it begins with driving as I was like, okay, I'm going to write voice memos as I'm driving to work, and then I'll write them down. And that only happened once. It never happened again.
I do dragon dictation.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little bit harder for the fiction pieces, but if I'm working like on a magazine piece.
Oh, right. That would work well. Yeah. Because with fiction, it would just be like,
There's a lot of that.
What do you think? Oh, you're just a machine, aren't you? Oh, no. Yeah, no, that wouldn't work at all for me.
You're right.
Yeah. It was, instead I did a lot of podcasts and Audible.
Yeah.
Radio and...
Speaking of podcasts, you're listening to KUT's The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. And we're talking to Amelia Gray, who's just released her fourth book, Gutshot, a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. See how I did that?
That was really brilliant.
I know.
Well done.
Thank you. I'm very good at this. I'm very good at this. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, continuing on what you were talking about the novel. It's interesting, your short stories, some of them are flash fiction. AMPM had a lot of flash fiction, and some of the pieces in Gutshot are really short. How do you take that energy and that kind of dream logic, that fever dream logic, and incorporate it into something larger, like a novel which needs a bigger structure and demands a more overarching vision?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's partly what the thing is composed of.
Yeah.
Because Gutshot was like a pretty small idea. So mm-hmm. he gets shot in the gut. He's going to go see a couple people who are representative, we'll say. And, you know, and like you go to the doctor, then maybe you would want your mother. And then you want, you know, your God. And that's, you know, that's about it.
That's it.
And so I would say it'd be very difficult to make anything much longer than that. Probably Kafka could do it, but I can't, you know. And then whereas Threats, for example, was that's more of a there's an image. There's this man and woman. They're sharing the staircase. They're looking at each other, and she's dying. And there are more questions and answers, like, why is she down there? Where did the blood come from? And then more questions like, what does she do for a living? And what does he do for a living? And what kind of house are they in? Where do they live? And what's that like? And who are their friends and their enemies? And what are their parents like? And so that kind of spiderwebs out into this like big narrative that you kind of can't ignore. Whereas I gave no thought to the reality of the gutshot man or the man who shot him. I didn't think about that at all. I think of them and having this like Wild West kind of standoff, and then the man just vanishes in my mind.
Yeah.
And I was reading that and realizing I think it's set kind of in my parents' backyard where there's a fence you can hop over and you run for the hills, which is strange. But it's all just cobbled together bits of life in order to support like a pretty simple central idea.
So with one of your short stories, you'll write and just allow that like a strange image or a strange moment to play out.
Mm-hmm.
But in a novel, you need basically like a deeper hole at the beginning, mm-hmm. with more darkness or more questions, more unknowns.
Yeah, like it needs a little more space.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that both... well, whenever I've started a novel, I guess I have started four or five. And whenever I start, it's like with an image.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know if you have the same thing, but it's like this one thing, like, okay, they're standing at the top of the stairs, or okay, this family is at dinner or something, and the kid is licking the tablecloth or something. I kind of have no idea, like no idea what I'm trying to say or what I'm getting at. Whereas in the short stories, especially the really short ones, I'm like, it's all idea. It's this is the idea. Like when you live in the moment, you screw yourself or whatever.
That's from the first story in Gutshot.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
A pretty brilliant, disturbing introduction into the collection.
Yeah, thanks.
In the moment.
Reader beware. Yes. Yeah. It's kind of that story came up with, but I was in a meditation class at the time, going every week, I guess, or every couple of days. It was a hard, stressful time. But in LA, you get this great like meditation place right down the road, as you do, and just have a green juice while you enjoy that. It's lovely. I mean, it's very much like Austin in that way, too. But I don't know. But they were like, you just experience every moment divorced from the past and future, and just see it rushing by as a river, and you're a stone in the river, and it felt so good and so right. But I also kind of wanted to make fun of the comfort I got out of that and like kind of push it and be like, well, what's it like if you really, really do that to the extreme? It's basically a walking straw man argument. That's sorry, but it's fine.
I want to ask you too, in this collection, there's a lot of, relationships, of course, but there's like couples, that brand new lovers, like in the moment. There's lovers who have been together for a lot longer. There's mother and child.
And there's one in Curses, and there's one in on the light. Wait,
House Proud as well,
right? Oh yeah,
which was pretty horrifying. and so many of these relationships, they're bizarre because they are working and they're poisonous.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that. Are people just poisonous to each other?
Yeah. Life is a deadly condition.
Yeah.
And we are poisonous to one another. Yeah, that's not inaccurate. Well, I mean, something I think about a lot is how, you know, it doesn't matter if you live your life right. It doesn't matter what you do. I mean, you're going to die. But also, you're entrenching yourself into a set of ideas, into like a rut that you just can't get out of. Like, no matter what. I would say almost across the board. I mean, I try not to, like, but you're walking a path, you know, to go to work, and I'm thinking about this in my own life, to go to work, to go home, I watch TV or I read the news. I think about things in kind of the same way. I experience life with the same people around me. We have the similar interactions. We go to the same places, and the rut gets deeper and deeper, and the ground goes farther away. And it's this, and that's what relationships are, and that's what life is. And it's really scary to me.
Wow. Yeah. You know, it's interesting talking about ruts, because ruts also are in some ways another word for rituals, right?
Yeah.
Repeated actions that either take on meaning or lose meaning that they originally had.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny because a lot of your characters are in their relationships have their own rituals in House Proud, but also House Heart.
Yes.
They have the game that they've played before in some way.
Right.
And that's a horrifying story.
Yes, horrifying.
Yeah.
And not safe for radio, probably.
No, I would. Yeah. Goodness gracious. That will definitely keep us in the podcast realm if we talk about that story too much. But also fascinating and fantastic.
She also has one where in that story, she opens cabinets and imagines the outside. That's kind of that's a safer ritual. But it's weird. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so in that story, without, I don't want to give it away to folks who are running out to their local bookstore now.
Yeah.
But within that story, a couple invites a woman that they've hired, presumably a prostitute.
Yes.
And then they lock her in a grate behind the wall and force her to live in the vents.
Yes.
Surrounding their house or inside their house.
Yeah.
And for days and days and weeks and for an unknown amount of time.
Right.
Fun stuff.
Yeah. Lighthearted romp. It's a romantic comedy.
It's a romantic comedy. Yeah. But that story in itself, it deals with the relationship of a long relationship between the couple.
Mm-hmm.
But also there's aspects of employer and employee and
ownership.
Ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And
like the sex trade thing.
Yeah.
And how strange and how odd that is. And then also, again, how the couple has this series of ideas that they've created about life and what's important to them and, you know, how she fits in or doesn't fit in and kind of they've created this trap for her. But they also the protagonist of the story is also trapped in this place and in this series of ideas. And yeah,
there's a line, and I'm going to misquote it, but it's a line in the story about where the man says, "We all create these borders in our lives."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And that's the rut you're talking about.
Oh yes,
and the relationships are part of that. That these self-made barriers.
Right. Yeah, and that's a pretty central idea to a lot of what I'm writing about, I suppose, now that we think about it. We're really getting somewhere with this.
I know. This is like therapy for both of us.
Thank God. Yeah, we'll just trade money. I'll give you 20 bucks. You give me 20 bucks.
Sounds good.
Great.
I don't have 20 bucks. Can I borrow 20 bucks?
Absolutely.
Great. I want to know, what did you read as a kid?
I got into my parents' bookshelf pretty young, and they had The World According to Garp, and they had Richard Brautigan.
Yeah.
Like Still Life with Watermelon.
Yeah.
And a lot of Tom Robbins.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some Our Bodies, Ourselves. It's a good combo.
This is explaining so much.
So much.
Yeah.
Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. A couple of Vonneguts and some lesser Vonneguts and greater Vonneguts both.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was a good... I mean, I'm talking like early teens at this point, I guess. Before that, it was fables and you know, your standard stuff. I read all of Little House on the Prairie.
Did you?
Really fast, back to back.
Oh, my kids are reading that right
yeah?
now. They just love it.
I can't believe that she's 10.
My daughter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Me either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost teenage years.
Let's just slow down
on
that.
Right, exactly. Slow down time.
Yeah. She's definitely at the point in life where she's like, Dad, don't come in here. I'm putting away my clothes.
Yes.
And I'm, you know, and
yes.
Then also, Dad, I'm going to the toilet. Can you come in and talk to me for a while? And she's both. I'm like,
all at once.
Yeah.
I'm confused.
She's right there on the edge.
So cool. But yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was an omnivorous reader, and I still like to do that stuff. Like to, you know, I don't know if you get this feeling, but I lose patience with fiction, and I start in on plays and screenplays and poetry and nonfiction, and then only internet, and then back to fiction.
And your mother is an artist.
Yeah, she has an MFA, and she's a handmade paper maker.
Oh.
And she also works at a YMCA.
Wow.
Yeah.
And your father, an engineer.
He is, yeah. Although he also, he was an artist and did a lot of drawing and jewelry making and painting, yeah.
Wow.
There's lots of great parental art about the house. So
yeah.
I kind of had this feeling that of art being a kind of more approachable thing. I was very lucky in that way.
As a kid, you were quick to know that this is something you can do.
People do.
People
yeah.
do.
Yeah. And lucky too, because all of my fiction or my English classes were all Milton and Shakespeare and that untouchable greatness that is just, you think that maybe statues made it or
right.
were gods and, you know, and then when I was in college, I saw Tobias Wolff read and
yeah.
then Charles Baxter and just really, it was just like a light off in my head, just connecting the art that I grew up around, the kind of visual art and the fiction, word art. And like merging them together.
And did you study with Ron Carlson? Didn't
uh-huh.
you? Yeah.
Yeah, the genius.
Yeah. How yeah. was that?
Oh, so good. Yeah. I mean, that was my first creative writing class, and I must have been 19.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this kind of packed basement room at Arizona State. And he made all of the students go home and learn the last line of Araby by James Joyce.
Yeah.
And then come in and he was going to pick us at random to recite it. And I was so scared and had never done any kind of performance based thing at all that I really worked hard. And I think I've still got it. I mean, it's just one line, but it's like, as I gazed into the darkness, I saw myself as a creature driven and derided by vanity. My eyes burned with anguish and anger.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a heavy ending.
Yeah.
I would really love... I need to learn the last paragraph of The Dead because
yes.
that's even better.
That would be something wonderful to have
yeah.
living word by word in your heart.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's falling softly over, you know, our last end of living in the dead. No big deal.
I bet somewhere out there there's a creative writing instructor making sure that people are memorizing the last... few pages of Gutshot.
Thank you. I doubt it, but I appreciate the sentiment. But Ron was, I mean, he was just such a great teacher, and he also had the sense of like a very of like a practical element to it of just like write and read it like write down Araby and see what that feels like to actually write it. You know,
the physicalness of
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Make it. And
I wanted to ask you about that because I've heard you talk about writing in a really refreshing way, where you move past the romanticized idea of the writer's life and you talk about the working job of a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that as your approach to writing.
Yeah. It's important to me to talk about having a day job because it's such an unromantic thing, but it's important. I think people get the wrong idea, and I think it's this fiction of the writer as Godhead and as of, you know, coming down from the mount to deliver my ideas about the world unto the people. And the reality,
and we are grateful.
Yes, thank you. You're welcome. And but you know, I work in advertising, and
yeah.
it's no tragedy. It's a job.
Yeah.
And so the work of it is actually, you know, for a year and a half was to get up, go to work and write about 150 words, maybe a sentence if it was a bad day, maybe a couple paragraphs. Or there was a couple days when I locked myself into a soundproof room in the office and wrote for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, this is it. And different writers have different processes. Like a friend of mine who edits TV shows will work on that all week, very long hours, and then he'll write fiction for 10 hours a day over the weekend. And that's something I could never do, but he does fine. And but to me, it's like just thinking about a story or thinking about an idea a little bit every day. And then your brain is kind of doing the work of like slow cooking it when you're not like physically writing it.
Right.
And then going back and editing it. And maybe that's another thing that religion gave me, of this desire, this ability to work and try to better yourself and create and think, and but also to like forgive yourself.
Hmm.
You know, or this forgiveness concept, you know, of like, well, I haven't sat down to edit the novel in 3-4 days, and that's a very long, unsettlingly long time for me, but I will.
Yeah.
I'll do it on the plane tomorrow.
Right.
And
yeah, I guess Christianity, the theology is based around the fact that we're not perfect.
Right, right. Yeah. We're doing the best we can, man. And just try again. It's not this, and if rarely, I don't know. I get the impulse too to really just like, I want to do the best job I can on this one story. And there's so much pressure to make it so perfect. And it comes out this little deformed nut that you just have to like swallow or throw out or something.
Yeah,
strange.
Yeah. But there's something too. I mean, you know, I always love Faulkner talking about Sound and the Fury.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, "Oh, that's my favorite of my failures."
Oh, wow!
And someone saying a failure, it's a masterpiece. And yeah. He said, "Ah, you don't know what I was going for."
Oh, wow! Yeah, and I remember Barry Hannah said that every story starts in your mind as a diamond, and every time you sit down to write it, the diamond begins to crumble to dust.
Yeah.
And it just, the more you write it, and he was saying this as an old man, he's like, the more you do it, the less it crumbles, but it still does.
It's, yeah.
You know.
That's true. No, maybe it reverts back to coal. but coal you can use to warm and
yeah,
run things.
Absolutely.
Diamonds are just pretty.
Right. I like this metaphor.
No, we should just keep going.
How far can we push this?
Too far. I think I already did.
It's gone. Yeah. Can I borrow 20 bucks?
Sure. If you could lend me some.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah.
So within that, with the world of having a day job, and I don't know a writer who doesn't have a day job.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I find myself the constant struggle of like, well, how do I pay the bills? And it usually leads to fun things. I do, you know, shows at the Alamo or weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or I call up KUT and say, can I have a podcast?
Yeah.
Because that's where the money is.
They're paying you for this?
I don't know. I don't know. There's rumors, but I get free coffee every second episode. I get a free
really?
Cup of coffee.
It's really good
yeah.
coffee.
I know. It's not bad. Next time I get creamer.
Oh.
So if this one goes well. But do you find that feeds your writing in some way? I mean, I you and I are both friends with the singer-songwriter Southpaw Jones. And mm-hmm. Southpaw Jones, about 7 years ago, he saved up a bunch of money and he took a year off any work. And he said, I'm just going to write songs.
Yeah.
And he had the hardest time
right,
writing songs. And he just felt that that was just – it didn't work for him. So
right.
he was thrilled to get back into the workforce.
Right.
Because it squeezed his creative energy into
a space.
A space.
Yeah, that's a really good good point and a good strategy. And it also kind of motivates me anyway to think like, okay, I've worked 8 hours today to make a banner ad for a car.
Right.
I think I can write my little short story. You know, I think I can do what actually feels real. Because comparatively, you know, it's just this banner ad,
yeah.
You know? And I try not to think about the fact that more people will see the banner ad than will read all of my work combined throughout my life and after my death. But
you don't know that.
I do. They bought a million.
Oh. Of them.
I do know that. But it gives me a very practical sense of the work as because you do have to elevate the work a little bit. And when it's all alone on its own, that becomes a very impossible thing. The idea to take a hiatus, which sounds so, so good, especially when I'm just exhausted, too tired to even watch TV at the end of a long day of work, like a hiatus, like a sabbatical, you know, but I think that takes such a level of dedication and meditation and stuff that I'm not sure I have yet. Maybe someday.
Yeah.
Because it does sound nice.
Yeah.
I would like a vacation.
A vacation where all you do is
work.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you have this feeling, but I was just talking to my dad who is going to retire pretty soon, in theory. And I said, well, I think I'm going to work every day till I die. That's the deal. Until my mind goes.
Right.
And then I'll keep going. And
that's when the stories will really pop.
Go. Yeah. A little Nietzsche kind of feel to it when my brain starts disintegrating.
Right. Like a diamond.
Ah, oh, beautiful.
You were talking about your religious upbringing and how that had an impact on both your writing process, but also your writing.
Mm-hmm.
How about now? Do you have a religious practice now?
Not a practice precisely. I do like thinking about it, reading about it. And I'd say my practice, such as it is, has gotten a lot more meditative.
Yeah.
I would say that the idea of God kind of fades as the years pass and becomes more impersonal, but doesn't vanish entirely. I don't know how to sum it up in a great larger sense, but I think it's a nebulous, wonderful mystery to think about and consider. And my thoughts on the matter don't mean a thing to the operation of the world. So that's lucky. but I do like to think about it. And as I think, I don't think I've written a very, a work that really approaches that. The novel I'm writing now, which is historical fiction, does kind of go into it conceptually a little bit, but largely because most of the characters are atheists or agnostics, and the concept of atheism is very curious to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering, one of the reasons I was asking, I think there's a question that reoccurs to me again and again, and it impacts my writing, but it also impacts my reading. And it's a question like, does life have meaning?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the more I've thought about it, the less I understand even what that means.
What that means, yeah.
Yeah, that it seems almost like an absurd collection of words. but I think about that when I read your stories too. Of there are characters who are looking for meaning. There are characters who are dealing with an absurd world that will never reach their ideals, and so they take actions to hide themselves in that world or reimagine it. And so I was wondering if you felt or think about that question.
Sure. It's a big one.
Yeah, I know. I went deep.
Yeah.
Let's just go.
Yeah. The meaning of life. Do you think about it? Yes.
And what is it?
Right. Okay. Exactly. I will say that I've gotten more into the Stoics.
Yeah.
Than ever.
As the Greek Stoics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This comfort of, you know, if if there was nothing after death, then death should not, you shouldn't be afraid of it, because there's nothing. And it's just, that should be, that is fine. And it's kind of like the fence line is, the posts are put up and the fence is drawn. And you know, I'm probably getting that idea wrong too. So don't worry.
Oh, that sounds about right.
I think about that. And I read fiction more than ever as a comfort, when I didn't used to as much read it as a comfort. I used to read it more to kind of be electrified and to vicariously live. And, you know, I'm picturing like Richard Brodigan and this kind of romps and fun and funny stuff. But now as I keep rolling on through life, I start, you know, have these thoughts of it ending, and the thoughts of what happens after that, or during it, or, you know, or what is the point of it, if there's a point of it, and what to do if there's not a point of it. I mean, these are all very troubling ideas. So I've started picking up things and devouring things as trying to comfort myself, soothe myself a little bit, try to.
Who are the readers that you, or the writers that you go to in that?
Well, the Stoics are good. And I also like Ben Laurie for that kind of stuff. I really like Noy Holland for that. David Foster Wallace is big. Cesar Ira, Edward LeVay. The poets finding more. I think it's a patience thing. I don't know. As I get more patient with life and myself, and sitting, like actually physically sitting in a place, Richard Sykin and Ron Klasnick, and I just kind of scattershot at a million different things that are sort of different varieties of comfort, like comfort in depravity, comfort with loss, and comfort in godlessness, and comfort with God, and you know, like that whole big old variety. But
would you describe your own stories as comforting?
Yeah, some of them for sure. Yeah. I think these are the fables. A story about a couple that's going to have a child, and probably the man is on his way out, but the child will lead the woman through life.
Yeah.
It's terrific to me. Yeah. Or the, you know, at the end of House Proud, and they've, you know, you find love in a place and it's real, and that's a thrilling kind of thing.
At the end of House Proud, I found a perfect ending for the collection.
Oh, thanks.
And beautiful and real and in no way sentimental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I was going for that.
Yeah.
I was reading Train Dreams right around when I was writing that. And there's like a cabin in the woods out there in Train Dreams, I believe. Yeah. Whenever I have a microphone in front of me, I think I'm just making up everything.
That's okay. You can.
Good. No one's going to check this.
We'll edit out the lies.
Thank you. That's what I need. I like to go on road trips, and when you're in the car, I create something called car truths.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you say anything and we're not going to check on it.
Right.
We're going to be like, yeah. And then when Bill Murray, after he left Fleetwood Mac to star in Ghostbusters, he said to them, you know, guys, I think we're all working too hard. And have you read the Stoics, including but not limited to Marcus Aurelius?
Wow. Yeah. He said that.
He did.
That's fantastic.
100%. Hmm. Yeah. And it just sets the truth. Don't look it up.
No, I don't. Why?
How dare you?
I wouldn't. I'm not going to do that. This is KUT's The Write-Up. I'm Owen Edgerton, and we are talking to writer Amelia Gray, writer of short stories, novels, and also screenplays. You've been dabbling in the screenplay world.
Dabbling.
How's that?
It's the right word.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fun. It's super fun.
Yeah.
I I wrote a feature, and I've written a couple of things with partners, mm-hmm. and just to try out that feeling. And yeah.
Both for film and for television?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I just wrote a spec of Black Mirror. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
So good. Mm-hmm. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, you know, it's so current. It's so like, you know, like the original Twilight yeah. Zone was so responsive to its time and, you know, came like 9 years or 10 years after the, or no, it was like 14 years after we dropped the bomb. Well, let's say after they dropped the bomb.
It is your country.
That's true. That's ownership right there. Oh, man. Now I'm depressed.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. But anyway, the Twilight Zone was so responding to the feelings of this post-war America.
Anxiety yeah.
and the feeling of being watched. And
yeah.
And then Black Mirror, in a similar way, is all about, you know, collecting your life into your phone and online and kind of creating a version of yourself in the cloud. And then you're watching American Idol, where people are, you know, make or break their whole lives on stage. And I don't know, it's just, it's a goofy show, too, but it's been so compelling to just think about, you know, what's the most current, modern kind of responsive writing that you could do. Like, can I write a Black Mirror spec? So then I ended up doing that.
So in film world, which is, of course, so dependent on imagery, television and film, and you are such a master of finding such a disturbing, perfect, wonderful pinpoint image. Hmm. Are you finding that you're drawn to stories that match the fables that you write, or do you find that they're a little more based in reality, or...?
I would say I have been writing fables. I haven't really thought about it, I guess. They are fables. I mean, Black Mirror is all fables.
Yeah, Black Mirror is definitely, yeah.
And it also has this kind of divorced from reality element to it. Yeah, and I like that about it. And then the other feature I wrote was historical fiction, which is also has a feeling of being like a couple of degrees off of our reality because it happened in the past.
Yeah, something other.
Right.
Yeah.
And I like that. And it frees it up a little for me mentally. Yeah. But yeah, I'm drawn to it. And I feel fewer, a little less confinement when I write that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have nightmares?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. What are my nightmares? I had a 3-hour dream where I was delivering a lecture on integrated marketing technology.
That is a nightmare.
It's pretty scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the content we're creating creates us. Something like, okay, great. Yeah. No, I remember one of my first memories is of a nightmare I had I think I had this nightmare when I was 5 years old, and in it I'm like sitting in the shopping cart in one of those little places where you put the kid and it was like a Target cart, and I was in the parking lot of a building, and it was like a brick building with no windows or doors, and I knew that my mother was in there and it was on fire.
Oh gosh.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
For a little kid.
Yeah.
I mean, kids are heavy. I don't think that's unique to me. Kids have heavy stuff they think about.
They do.
Straight up death. I mean, a friend of mine, his kid, really obsessed with John Lennon and then learned and also obsessed with dinosaurs, and then learned kind of on the same day at the Natural History Museum that John Lennon had died and became bones, and the dinosaurs were once alive and then they were dead. And then he kept walking up to people, this 5-year-old, and saying, "You're going to die. You're going to die. You're going to die." Just like touching them and then moving on to the next person. Just like, "You're going to die."
Wow.
Yeah. Good.
That's pretty, that's in a way, that's what you're doing with your books.
Yeah. Except just kind of touching myself. You're going to die.
One last question that I've got. You'd mentioned, we were talking earlier about how long the process of these stories, they span a long period of life. I often find that with a book, there's something that has happened to me in the process of creating a book, even a collection, which is a little more here and there. Do you feel that something in writing this book, something changed for you? Did you go through a change or a period of life that this book covers?
Sure, yeah. It was 6 years. That's a long time. And to go from, to go from dating somebody to not dating somebody, to being in love, to not being in love, to dating somebody again, and and to like move through that stage of life, and then to move physically from one place to another, and then to grow up a little, and then to have, friends die, or to have to kind of experience that in a very, very direct and non-remote way.
Yeah.
And to just like the business of life. Which
do you think the writing of this book changed you?
Maybe it helped. Maybe it helped me think about things or crystallize some ideas in my mind. Maybe. Surely, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I would be like without writing. I wish that we had a side-by-side comparison, you know, of the feral human that I would be without my work. You know, just going through life like a terrified child touching people. Or not, yeah.
Touching people and telling them,
you're gonna die. You know, I'd probably be in jail.
If you weren't writing?
Yeah.
And then when you're in jail, you'd probably take up writing.
Yeah. That works out. Listen, can I borrow $20?
Sure, okay. Sure. Rebecca, do you have $20? Cool. KUT's got it covered.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. The Write-Up is produced by Rebecca McEnroy. It's engineered by David Alvarez. And today we've been thrilled to have novelist and short story writer Amelia Gray. Thank you so much for being here, Amelia.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you for having me.
Make sure to keep listening and keep reading.